Welcome to Deeply Rooted, a web series on mindset. My name is Tony Wisdom, aka Tony Gaines. I've spent over 20 years in the music business as a producer, engineer, label owner, and executive. This show is dedicated to changing the narrative on success. I reached out to the most successful people I know. I want to know what drives them, their greatest mistakes, their best advice, their secrets to success, and how all of that has shaped who they are today. Take a journey with us. There we go, man. Hey, what's going on, y'all? Yeah, we're in. We're live, bro. So, Deeply Rooted, Season 1, Episode 7, with my man, Lowercase Frank, a.k.a. X-Dash.
Damn.
You know,
before... Nobody's called me that name in a while, by the way.
You're going to always be X-Dizzle to me,
it's
man.
It's fun. I appreciate it. It's part of my past.
So anyway, man, obviously, y'all, before we get started, you know, forgive me if I get emotional, but we lost a real one last night, and, you know, I just want to really send my love, condolences, and all the good energy in the world to the Dotson family. Y'all know, if you know Willie, then you know what type of impact he made. You know, from guest one, Will the Weirdo, he talked about writing your own chapter, you know. I never really seen anybody write their own chapter like Willie did when the world counted him out. When he was down at his lowest, he bounced back and he dedicated his life to the kids, to my son, to his son, you know, and he got them little dudes to college, man. And, you know, like James said on episode 2, you know, people gonna hate, there's gonna be haters. You know, it's just a part of the grind, it's a part of the ascension. You know, and Willie handled that better than anybody. He's not a basketball dude. He just loved the kids. So he dedicated himself to learn the game and get them dudes to college. I love you, bro. Thank you, man. All right, bro.
I'm sorry. That's heavy. I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah, man. You know, life can throw you some twists and turns. You know, you never know, man. You really gotta just give it your all, man. And bro did that. So, Frank, man, I really appreciate you again for taking the time to do this, man. You know, this show isn't about music or anything like that, but I definitely, you know, can you, you know, in a minute or so, just kind of professionally tell me who you are.
So my name is Frank Hensley. I grew up in Raymore, Missouri, just south of Kansas City. Throughout my high school, middle school through high school, I fell in love with rap music. I memorized every piece of rap music I could get my hands on and practiced it in my bedroom in the mirror. Crazy stuff. I just loved hip hop. I was enamored by it. And that love persisted through college. And in college, I really decided to become a rapper and go for mine, I guess you would say. And I made a couple of albums. You helped produce the first one and the second one. And that led me to all kinds of opportunities. I did theme songs for Jason Whitlock at the Kansas City Royals. We had songs on the radio in Kansas City on 95.7. I would buy airtime on Hot 103. I made it a point to know anybody and everybody in the city that was affiliated with rap music. And I really tried to do that old thing, that old saying where you start where you live and go 50 miles out and then go 100 miles out. And
yeah.
I traveled with other rappers, a lot of the rappers you know, and grew up with and around. And that led me out to California, where I interned for Interscope Records for a little bit. That landed me a job at Interscope Records, which led to another job, which led to another job, which led to another job. And fortunately for me, I found a great music career on the business side of it in the industry. And I was able to use the passion that I had for rap music to sort of carve out a path for me. I don't really rap anymore. I'm not trying to be a rapper, but I still do mess around with music from time to time. Everybody probably, it's like a hobby for me, I guess, still.
Yeah.
And I'm able to sort of live my dreams through helping others, you know, create their dreams and carve their paths. So I'm very blessed to have, to still be around and involved in an industry that I'm so passionate about, and I get to wake up every day and sort of live my dream. So I don't know if that was...
No, that's dope. What it, and I think we talked about this before, but if we haven't, I'm going to tell you now. Like, I've used you as an example in raising my kids several times. I mean, I think I have sent you a message and told you that because, you know, when I met you, bro, you were, I would say, 18, 19 years old. We had just completed the Bomb Squad album, and we hadn't moved downtown to 5150 yet. We were still at Will's. And I remember meeting you, and like you said, I could see the passion you had for the culture right out of the gate. Now, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but, you know, I didn't want to do that project, bro. Like, when we started, and it wasn't a thing about you more than we had so many other people who kind of deserved that shot. But by the time you got to your second album, bro, you were a better rapper than most of those dudes. And it was because you just went all in. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I saw you, bro. I saw what you would do. You know what I mean? Driving from Raymore to Lawrence to, you know, to here to there, being at every show, you know, with your big ass FUBU coats on and shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, bro, you really went and got it. And then to take that and go to LA and reach the heights that you have just from, like, sheer determination, bro. Like, so my hat's off to you for that, man.
They told me I couldn't, mm-hmm. and I decided to prove that I could. And so I think that's, I appreciate you recognizing the determination. You know, I said I started off rapping in my bedroom, like memorizing every rapper I could. I can probably emulate every rapper in the game, but I think what you probably saw when you first met me is that I didn't have my own voice. And mm-hmm. I still don't think I have my own voice, even after all these years of rapping, because I spent so much time trying to study Tupac and Biggie and Eminem and get their inflection down and get that it sort of ruined my ear for my own voice. And when you met me, I could write, but I wasn't on beat. I didn't know what, I'd never really been on a microphone, so I'd never recorded in a studio. When I first met Brian Dennis, the way I started rapping was I was at a nightclub, an 18 and up nightclub in Kansas City called Bazookas, and there was a girl in there named Layla that said, "Oh, you rap? Oh, well, Tech N9ne's best friend Brian Beazle Dennis is right there." And so my 18-year-old, you know, not gonna take no for an answer self, went right up to him and started rapping, and I probably wasn't even very good, but he saw, like, whoa, this kid's in my face, like, yeah. And a few days later, him and Don Juan called me, and Don Juan was a little bit more aggressive, he was a little bit more the producer, and like, trying to hear what I sounded like, and he could tell I wasn't, you know, on beat or very good, and so I had been on one microphone when I first met you, before you went to 5150 and we were out of Will's. That one of those first songs that I recorded in Will's garage was like the second song I'd ever recorded. So, you know, it's so interesting, you know, to look back at that stuff, because I never really felt, I never really felt like I was X-Dash. I just felt like that was somebody that we was the vehicle for the passion that I had, but I didn't really, it didn't really match me as a voice. Like, I think I was just trying to get in any way I could. And I think that if I could go back to my 16-year-old self and tell my 16-year-old self that you don't have to be a rapper to still work in the music industry, I don't know that I ever would have picked that microphone up, you know? But I saw Diddy grabbing microphones, so I thought I had to grab a microphone. You see what I'm saying?
That's so dope. That's great, man. I love that. Okay, so let's get into it. So, who is Frank Hensley?
Well, I am a husband and a dad, and I am a senior director at a major music company in Los Angeles. I am a huge fan of hip hop and poetry and spoken word poetry. I am I wouldn't call myself an activist, but I'm a strong enthusiast of the Democratic Party. I come from a political family, so deep-rooted Missouri Democrat is in my veins. That's almost like a dinosaur now, a deep-rooted Missouri Democrat. Those almost don't exist anymore, but and especially if they move to Los Angeles and don't vote there. So, but I think that I just try to be a good human being, and I try to surround myself with positivity and things that make me feel good. And I try to not associate with things that don't make me feel good. No doubt. So.
Okay. How do you define success?
I think that success looks different for every single person. And I think that everybody's path is different. So, you know, I interned at a record company. That internship led to a job, but that path might not be the same path for somebody else. And it's definitely, my path isn't the same path as Diddy's. So everybody has a different path, and everybody has a different gauge of success. I think that you have to define what that is for you. And what keeps, you know, we talked about passion and drive. What you, you know, if you can wake up every day and you're still hungry for whatever it is you're chasing and you're part of that, you know, you're not going to succeed if you quit. So there's probably some good saying that goes around that, but it's not coming to me right now. But if you quit, you're not going to make it. So the only reason you really succeed is because you just keep trying and trying and trying and trying and trying again. And I think that every day you fail, and every day you get better, and you have to just keep pursuing whatever that true north is for you. If it sounds like it's basketball for your son, for me, it's to be a great music industry man behind the scenes, a music man. I'm in marketing, so, you know, marketing and sales and the streaming business is really where I live. And there's a lot of creativity to that. So I wake up every day sort of laser focused on how I can be better at that and how I can move my company and the artists that I work for forward. You have to define what that is for you, whoever you are that I'm talking to right now. You have to find what that is for you, and you have to not take no for an answer, and you have to wake up every day going for it. And you're probably really never, ever going to be successful if you, in your own mind, if you're hungry. I think I'm successful, but I want more, and I want to be better, and I want to do better, and I want to have more meaningful relationships in this business, and I want to help more artists. I want to break an artist. I want to be responsible for someone being and accomplishing their dream and hitting that stage. So in a roundabout way to answer your question about what is success, I don't think you can really define it because it's so intangible. You have to make that up for yourself. You have to figure out what that is inside of you and determine that for yourself. And hopefully, you know, on when you take your last breath and you look back, you say, okay, I was successful because I achieved all of the goals that I set out for. So.
Great answer, bro. I love that answer. Now, is that Is that the same answer you would have had at 19?
No, at 19, I don't think I knew what I wanted at 19. And I think that's part of the problem. You know, I didn't know who Frank was because I was this X-Dash character. Yeah. And on the first album that you recorded with me, There Goes the Neighborhood, I didn't even want to be called X-Dash. My rap name was X1. But Sticky Fingers from Onyx had a little brother named X1 or something that died, like right around the time I met Keith. And Big Keith was like, no, we're not going to put out your album if it's X1. So he changed it to X-Dash. And I went, okay. And we dropped the one off because it was an X, a dash, and a one. And so I think like on There Goes the Neighborhood, I look back at that and I just hear how young I am because I'm rapping what I think people want and not like what my true self is. And I'm rapping under a name that somebody else named me under, you know, somebody that I just didn't feel like I was. And then as I got into Workaholic, I felt like I was becoming more of my own voice. But I think until I moved to California, I didn't really realize who are you? Who is Frank? Yeah. And I got to sort of rediscover myself. I got to sort of reinvent myself. And, you know, everybody gets that opportunity. You don't have to be somebody else's version of who you are. I would say you just have to be yourself, figure out who you are and what you want. And as soon as you figure out those things, only you know that, then chase them.
Yeah. So I guess it would only be right at this point to acknowledge Keith, show Keith some love. Rest easy, big homie, man. I mean, I know he gave you a lot. He gave me a lot. Like, he put a battery in my back. He showed me a different way to hustle, you know. So much love to Big Key. And then right before the show started, I threw on some Workaholic joints. And Love and War, bro, man, like, you had your Leroy glow at that moment, man. Like, that's...
You know what I'm mad about Love and War, though? I have a version where it's not the deep voice. It's like it's my voice.
Yeah.
And that version to me is so much better. If I had one thing to go back and do, it would be to argue with Will more about that deep voice. Yeah. Will wanted that, and I went, you know what, okay. And I settled, but I love that version without it. But yeah, I sometimes revisit what I wrote there. That's probably one of the only songs from back in the day. That and the song Workaholic are songs that I really put a lot of my energy in.
Yeah, that's where I was like, okay, it's like this dude came out of his cocoon. You know, it's like a butterfly coming out of like I was really proud of you at that moment.
Thanks, man.
I think you probably alluded to it, but to be just more direct, what drives you?
Not failing, I think. And, you know, when I was a little kid, I was told, you know, this is before Eminem. It was back when there weren't that many white rappers, and it was sort of corny. The white rappers that existed were sort of corny, like Snow and Vanilla Ice and MC Search. And I think Search is a cornball. And
come on, man.
Yeah, fuck Search. he did that corny ass white rapper show.
Yeah, and I do remember.
He's wrong. That, so he's wrong for that. He kept screaming at kids, this is not a game. Like, yeah, it is a game. They're competing for $10,000 or something. So he's wrong for that. But I was just told no over and over and over. Like, no, you can't be a rapper. No, you're from a town where it's like predominantly white. You can't be a rapper. And I got into middle school at a private school. No, you can't be a rapper. In high school, no, you can't be a rapper. And all the time I'm like, I fucking am one. So fuck you, you know? And, and I think that's what drove me early on was just to like, just that angst of like proving people that they were racist, proving people that they were wrong. And as I got into college, it got worse. It was like the frat boy prep be white guys just got worse. And I just feel like I fought that. And so, you know, I grew a blue beard, if you remember, and I spiked it up and I would walk around campus. And, you know, all these kids, none of them believed me. You know, when I first went to William Jewell, I met Beazle when I was 18. I met Tech N9ne when I was 18. And then they formed Strange Music about 4 months after I met them. And so I saw Travis and Tech in the mall. I worked at Pacific Sunwear and I flagged them down, and I was like, I wasn't even 19 yet. And I said, Hey, Tech, yeah, I heard you guys started Strange, and can I help? Can I promote? And they gave me all these like snippets and promos and stickers and flats and shit. And I was on the original Strange Music Street team, and I would go to like Lee Summit and Raymore, and like I'd even go out to the Oak Park Mall, and I'd go up to North Kansas City, and all these goons that I went to college with, they all thought I was bullshitting until I would show up at a party with a trunk full of Tech N9ne snippets and just like bomb a party with kids. And I love that, because it was like at school you would see these little smarty art preppy fucks that would, you know, just sort of racist kids, and they would sort of like look down on other kids and shit, and they look down on me for wanting to be a rapper for sure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's what would drive me. I would just want to prove them wrong. I wanted to prove to them that, like, you know, the music I made was good. I wanted to prove to them that the things that I represented, like Strange and Tech and Kansas City rap, was good. I mean, there's so many more rappers that we associated with other than Tech that I helped out, you know? And I wanted to be part of that community. You know, like when you look back at Russell Simmons and Diddy and all these cats, there was a community around hip hop back in the day. If you had a Wu-Tang shirt on and I had a DMX shirt on and we saw each other in the mall, we would sort of nod and understand that we were part of the same culture. Will the Weirdo and Beazle met in the Wyandotte Mall. I'm not sure what that mall is called. Indian Springs Mall, because Will had a Public Enemy shirt on. And so I think, you know, growing up in your bedroom, listening to Biggie and Pac and hearing them rap with other rappers like Jay-Z or Nas or somebody else like that. And I wanted that community. I wanted to be with rappers. I wanted to rap on stage with rappers. I had all the people I associated with were rappers. And that drove me. And then wanting to become a famous rapper drove me. So that's what got me out of California. I mean, you have to move. You have to get, you know, you have to go for what's yours. And I think that passion, that drive to like prove people wrong, to prove people that your music is good, to prove to people that you can cut it, or you're not just a joke or whatever, that drove me, and I think still drives me today, because even though I'm not a rapper, I'm still in business. I'm still in the music business, and your credibility and your reputation and the person that you are is everything. So I'm not going to just agree with somebody because I'm afraid of them or because they have a higher, you know, rank than me or something. I'm going to tell them my opinion of something, because that's what I'm here to do. I'm the marketing guy or I'm the sales guy, depending on what hat I'm wearing. And I'm going to give you the best advice that I can give you. And it's going to be authentic, because I'm me, and I'm still trying to prove to people that that's okay to be me.
So great answer, bro. So I guess this kind of leads into that too. How has a failure or an apparent failure set you up for later success? And do you have a favorite failure?
Man, I think that I failed Beazle early on. I told him at one point in a fight, we were arguing, and I was young. I was like probably not even 20. And I told him, oh, you haven't done anything for me. And, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I found out later that he traded the Bomb Squad cover art for for me to get studio time. So that album that you worked on that you didn't really want to work on, that was because the cover art was free for the Bomb Squad, you know, for me to fuck around in the studio. And he did the same thing with Don Juan. I think that Misery Entertainment album cover that's gray that Don Juan has, Beasel traded the artwork for that. And I think that, you know, we made up before he died, and we were going to start a record label together before he died. And I think that I learned from that mistake, from that failure, because it didn't work out with Will and Keith the way I thought it would. And Brian, even though, you know, Will will tell you this too, Brian didn't really want me to just go to Will and Keith and be at Lock and Load Records and have an album with them. It's just that I got along with Will a little bit better than I got along with Don Juan. And Don Juan and I are great. We have a great relationship these days. You know, like we talk a lot. I've met his son, who's a great rapper. Don Juan introduced me to King Tech and Sway at South by 1 year, and I ended up getting to be on the Wake Up Show because of those relationships. So I owe a lot to Don Juan. But my point of telling you about this is that it's easy to not see the people that are helping you quietly. And I think that it humbled me later on, and then especially after he died, to recognize how much energy he put into me and how ungrateful I was to him in the moment. Yeah. And I think I've tried ever since then to be as grateful to people as possible. Hold on, somebody's beeping it. To be as grateful to people as I can be, even people that you don't know if they're helping you or not. You should be grateful to everybody. And I think that's what I learned from that failure, from that mistake.
Dope, man. Okay, if you could have one gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, what would it say and why?
It would say, "Who would Jesus bomb?"
Damn.
I don't know if that's what it would say, but that's what came to mind. There's so many political things that I would put on that. And I think there's a perfect one out there, but it changes by the day because we live in a 24-hour news cycle. So my billboard, I would hope, would be digital, but and so that I could swap out whatever "Who would Jesus bomb" phrase of the day be. And I would target Marco Rubio, and I would target Lindsey Graham, and I would target Ted Cruz.
Dope. That's a great fucking answer, man. What is one of the best or most worthwhile investments you've ever made? Could be money, time, energy.
Yeah, buying a home in Southern California, hands down. But to get that, I had to put in a lot of hard work. So the best decision I ever made was to move to Los Angeles. And I will, you know, I talk to a lot of kids who are like interns who come out here from all over the place. You know, living in Los Angeles is really a multicultural experience. I mean, there is every type of human being you can meet is in Los Angeles. And the ones that end up successful are the ones that don't quit and they stay and they work as hard as they can at whatever it is that their dream is. That goes for New York too. And I meet kids for coffee. Back before the pandemic, I would meet interns for coffee and give them advice, and I would mentor young people from my college. And the number one thing I tell them is you have to move. You have to move. You cannot stay in Lawrence. You cannot stay in Raymore. You cannot stay in Lee Summit. You cannot stay in Liberty, Missouri. You have to move. And it doesn't really matter where you move. You can move to Nashville. You can move to Chicago. You can move to LA or Atlanta, but you have to get out of your backyard. You have to get out of your cul-de-sac or your farm or wherever you live, because it's not there, whatever it is you're chasing.
Especially in the music industry, bro, you have to be where the industry is at, you know. And it's one thing about my career is, you know, and as we were talking about Willie earlier, you know, like my son made it to college to play basketball, to pursue his dream. And I just never thought it was right for me to leave my kids for my dream. It was more about their dreams. And to see, you know, all of my kids are pretty awesome, you know what I'm saying? And like to see them doing what they do makes it worth it. But you're absolutely right. Like if the, especially in music, like there's just, like if you're in LA, you can bump into Frank at Starbucks. If you're in Kansas City, you know, you have, he might be here for a couple of days.
The way, the way I got my internship at Interscope Records was I was at a party one night. I waited tables. When I first moved to LA, I waited tables at a Italian restaurant called Frankie's on Melrose. And I decided that I was going to try somebody that, that my parents knew. I didn't know one person when I moved to LA, by the way. I just knew I needed to move. My mom and dad are, were nice enough to provide me the support and the opportunity to do so. And that's everybody, that's again, everybody's path is different. Everybody doesn't have, you know, some of the financial backing that I was able to have in the early onset of just up and moving, but it doesn't mean you can't do it. And it doesn't mean that you can't find a way to do it. So no matter what your circumstances, the only person holding you back, or keeping you there is your own comfort zone. And I was so scared when I first moved to LA. I didn't know anybody. And this photographer that used to take our pictures, Lori Contino, she was really good friends with Beazle. And she told me, she was taking pictures for me right before I moved. And she told me, you'll find, you know, where you like to eat and you'll find where you like to hang out and you'll find an apartment or something that is your comfort zone and you'll find what makes you happy. And if you can just find that, you'll be all right. Like tough it up. And I just remember that stuck with me as I got out here and it, my best friend helped me move. I got in a U-Haul and I kissed my mama goodbye and went off, you know, on the southern route with my Tahoe and a U-Haul and my best friend. And it took like 30 something hours and we got there. My homie stayed, but then after a few days, my homie flew back and I was all by myself and I got homesick. And I did exactly what Lori said. I found comfort zones. I found people. One of the buddies that my parents knew out here, I had coffee with him just to see what he knew or who he knew. And he told me, join an acting class. And I was like, well, I'm not trying to be an actor. And he was like, nah, there's good looking chicks in acting classes and there's people in acting classes. And even if you're not trying to be an actor, you'll meet people and it'll be like a social, at least two nights a week, you'll get to like hang out with people. And so on the nights I wasn't waiting tables, I was hanging out in these acting classes. And about like a year in, and it was true, at like a year and a half in, I really hadn't much made it as a rapper. You know, it's funny because when you first met me, I was like nose to the grindstone. I would rap in your face. But when I got here, I didn't do that. I didn't grab open mics because I had opened up for Mystical or I'd opened up for Tech or I'd opened up for Two Live Crew or whoever. And to me, it was whack to grab an open mic. But that was a huge mistake. Maybe that's add that to the list of mistakes, because I should have done the same thing that I did when you met me, even if I wasn't very good, just rap in someone's face until they appreciate you or until you've made a name for yourself. That's what stand-up comics do in Los Angeles. They just, even if they bomb, they go up there every night. That's what actors do here in Los Angeles. Even if they fail, they go on another audition. If you want to be a rapper, move to New York or LA and don't think grabbing open mics is beneath you. Grab them and rap for you, whoever will listen to you. What was the beginning of that question, though? I got off track.
It was about the investments, but I want you to, how did you get your internship? That's what you were going into.
Right. Okay. So that's where I was going to. So one night I'm hanging out at an acting class with some kids and we go, you know, after the acting class, we go to a party or a house party or something. And I'm like crying about, you know, cause I'd been here a year and a half. I hadn't really made it as a rapper. I'm still waiting tables and going to clubs at night, but it's expensive and And so I'm crying to this girl, like, oh, I'm going to have to move home or whatever, you know. She says, well, if you want an internship at Interscope Records, I can call my homie. He works there. And this girl that I barely knew that I was just sitting next to at a party calls this guy. And next thing I know, I have an interview. And next thing I know, I'm getting the job. And that's to your point about how you can just bump into somebody. Like, that's what happens when you live in a place like New York or LA, because there's a network, there's a connection. Yeah. But there's ways of going about it that you learn, you know, when you get here. You know, when I first moved here, I did sort of do that. I took my Workaholic CD and I went to nightclubs where Suge Knight was and all these people that were, you know, Paris Hilton was dancing on a table, and I'm handing my CD out to people. And people are like looking at me like, that is a huge no-no. And in Kansas City, you would, that's what you would have done, right? And it's funny because I handed it to Suge one night, and like a couple weeks later, I see him, and I go, Suge, you listen to my shit? And he was like, nah. He was like, yeah, it was good. I go, you didn't listen to my shit, Suge? And he was like, nah, man, I didn't listen to it. Sorry. And I was felt like, why did, like, I was just in the moment, and I'm like, oh, you are so fucking stupid. What, like, what if that had gone the other way? Whatever.
And once you, hey, let me tell you, once you've been through the Kansas City scene, man, who the hell is Suge Knight? Right?
Well, and then, then one night I had, you know, I used to have that X Dash chain that I would wear, and you know, to me, it meant something to me. You know, when I played baseball, I played William Jewell baseball, college baseball. I had my number around my neck, you know, that kind of thing. So to me, to have like a little necklace with my charm on it, like that, that meant something to me. So. One night I was with Razcast and someone else, and J211, Raz's homie, pulled me aside and he goes, hey man, see that guy's chain over there? And this guy had like a diamond, like, you know, sailboat or something. It was just like blinded everybody in the club. And he goes, either get a chain like that or don't wear what you're wearing.
Ah, damn.
And I don't think I wore it ever since. And I think that, like, that's the thing. You're out of your comfort zone when you leave Kansas City or Lawrence or Topeka or wherever you're tuning in from. You have to adapt to, you know, if you move to the desert, you have to learn how to live in the desert. Like, you know, you move to a mountaintop, you have to learn how to live on a mountaintop. In LA, there's rules and a system and an organized hustle here. And you have to, you know, if you give it some time and you're patient and you do things like, you know, I heard Will talk about, I didn't know this about Will. I heard Will say that he worked at Guitar Center when he first moved to Atlanta, and that opened up a bunch of doors for him. Like, you have to not be afraid to go wait tables. You know, you're not going to get what you want right out the gate. You're not going to get a starring role in that film right out the gate. You're not going to get that big record contract right out the gate. You're not going to get all of that. You have to build towards those things. And so it starts with taking little baby steps, and even if it feels like a big leap, that's a baby step moving, because millions of people move to this city yearly. Yeah. And then they move home, and the ones that tend to succeed are the ones that stay.
Dope. Great answer, man. So what impact do you want to leave on the world?
I got to travel with people like Kendrick Lamar early on when he was doing Good Kid, Mad City. And even though all I did was just like organize some like in-store events for him, where he just signed autographs and I just made sure the record store was cool and he was cool and all that. And I did a little bit more than that. There were some other things we did for Kendrick, but I got to see his impact on humanity. And I got to see kids coming up to him like, you're our Tupac. And I didn't see it at first because I didn't really know the young man or his music at that time. And then as I worked with him a little more, I started hearing it, and then I started seeing it, and I started understanding why that generation of kids was saying that. And actually, even now, I like, he's one of my favorite rappers of all time. I put him up there with Tupac and Biggie. And he's much younger than me, and it's just amazing how much wisdom comes out of him. But I think that what impact I would want to have is to continue to help artists like him create those visions and those impacts. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done in this world. If 2020 taught us anything, it's that racism is alive and well, that cops beat people up and aren't going to stop, and shoot and murder and kill people and they're not going to stop, that And so the impact I want to have is to help those type of causes, political causes, you know, protecting our planet, help be a vehicle and a conduit and a supporter of projects like that to change. You know, you look back at like the 60s and all the great music that came out in the 60s, political music, and with Marvin Gaye, and I don't know if that was the 60s, maybe some of it was the 70s, but there are people who make that kind of music still. There are people that have impact still. You know, look at what Common, the rapper Common, is doing for the community. And I just want to be, I want to help that kind of art succeed. I want to help that kind of art make an impact, so that these movements actually change things. You know, without, there has to be culture around these movements for it to change. And I want to be part of, that's where I want to change. That's where I want the change to happen, is to impact those cultures.
That's fucking dope, man. That's a great answer, and you're doing that, bro. I share with you a funny story. All right, so the year that Kendrick, like Good Kid, Mad City came out, and Macklemore won the Grammy over Kendrick, right? Well, at this point in time, I was kind of really tapped out of new music. I stopped listening to new music, right? I was completely done. So I had only heard Pull Up, Drake, blah, blah. That was like the only record I heard off of Good Kid, Mad City, right? So I instantly assumed, because of the content of that song, right, that this was just another dumbass on some dumbass shit, right? Mm-hmm. Well, my son was a big Macklemore fan, and I took him out to Denver to see Macklemore at the Red Rocks. And I had listened to that album on the way there, because that's what they wanted to listen to. So it was like, and the album to me was incredible, because dude was just being him, right? I was like, damn, this is where X would have went. Like that, because, you know, you thought you didn't have an identity, but you absolutely 100% did.
Okay, right? Well, I appreciate you.
Yeah, you did. And that's me, not as a professional, that's me as a fan. Like, you know, because I became a fan of your music. You know what I'm saying?
I think what at the time that I really got out here to LA, some of the people that I ran with early on in Los Angeles, I mean, there were some gangs. I mean, there's gangsters in Los Angeles. I was running with some people, and everybody had tattoos and face tattoos and neck tattoos. And then look at how that perpetuated today. You know, you look at every single rapper has a face tattoo and looks interesting. That's not me, man. I couldn't have. I don't think I would have been able to be that character. And well, I think that that's what moving to Los Angeles did for me. It allowed me to not be a character anymore, and I could just be myself. Because where I was in Kansas City, I was trying to be somebody else. I was trying to prove to people that I could do something, but not doing it. It was so taboo to be a rapper that not all of my family supported my decisions to be a rapper. I got called all kinds of nasty words. I once said that a white rapper actually gets to see racism as like a third party. Like, mm-hmm. Of course I've known cops have been doing this for years, but the white community that I'm from either pretended to not know or really didn't know. But I knew it because I'm an observer of the community trying to be living in the culture, right? But then I would go home and tell people from my community that these things are happening, and they would call me every racist name in the book, you know? And I think we know the answer then, that they did know those things were happening, right? And they didn't care. But I think that like, it was important for me. I was in those acting classes, and one of the classes I took out here was an improv class. And it was funny because one of my homies came to visit me like a year into living here, and everybody was calling me Frank. And my homie goes, yo, why do they keep calling you Frank? And I go, because that's my real fucking name. He thought my name was X. He always called me X. He had never called me anything else. He never heard anybody call me Frank. And I'm like, that's like, how did this happen? Like, how did I create a alter ego? I mean, like, it'd be like if Eminem was stuck on Slim Shady or something. It's like, yeah. I created this monster. And so one night I was in acting classes and they were calling me Frank. And I was in this like scene where you had to improv. And I decided to just let go and be myself, not try to be a tough guy or not try to be like whatever it was that I had to act on the stage. And I just like let go and it like felt so good. It was like me, I got to be me. And then, so I would say to people out there that like, it's okay to create. It's okay to have these altered egos. It's okay to be a rapper and be have a completely other name. I'm not saying all that. I'm just saying that in order to really succeed at whatever you're doing, you have to tap in and have your finger on the pulse of who you are to be that instrument. You know, look at, listen to the rappers that we've named. Kendrick doesn't have to try to be Kendrick. He's being Kendrick. Yeah. You know, Tech N9ne is being Tech N9ne. Jay-Z's being Jay-Z. Biggie's being Biggie. They're telling you stories of what they see and where they're from and how. And I think that it took me a long time to figure out what Frank's, the person I was born, what Frank's, what does Frank see through his eyes? And how does Frank convey that? Yeah. And how does Frank go after what Frank wants? Not what X Dash wants, not what Will or what Tone wants of X Dash, but what does Frank want?
No doubt. And, you know, I'm learning that, you know, I'm doing a lot of reading this just this past year. I've been reading my ass off, man. And I'm learning about the ego, right? And the ego is basically just brain patterns firing off. You know, it forms habits from experience that we get. And then that ego is who we identify with as us, right? But really, it's just our brain and who our brain forms. And our brain is stupid and it can easily be manipulated. You know what I'm saying? But the part of us that is aware of the ego, the part of us that thinks about our thoughts, what we call our gut, that's who we really are. That's when you opened up in that acting class, you put the ego down, and you really became who you were. You know what I mean?
I think X-Dash was my ego, and I killed it, and I killed it.
That's dope.
And part of the way I became Frank and got to work, you know, be a senior director at a big music company is because I never once went in there acting like I was a rapper. I still rap. I still like to rap. I'll rap your ass off right now. But I didn't make anybody feel like I was in there every day trying to be that. And I think that can you imagine if every day I answered the phone, I was trying to hustle my own mixtape to somebody? Like,
yo,
I
what never, up? This ex Dizzle for Shizzle.
Right. One of the first jobs I got at Interscope was an assistant to a very powerful woman. And I recognized that I was probably the only rapper that ever sat in that seat. And not just like the only rapper. And because it just, that's not what people are, you know, that's not what rappers are trying to do. They're not trying to sit and answer phones as an assistant to somebody. And you can't really be both. I felt like I had to decide. And so I decided to take that opportunity that was given to me and take it very seriously and not, you know, not let maybe my, you know, I still want to grab a mic. I'm on the side of stages for lots of artists that you probably listen to.
Yeah.
And I want to go out there and grab the fucking mic from them so bad and just like bust a 16 and then dip off. But like, you can't do that. You can't hustle. You can imagine like every time I'm sliding a CD for Kendrick to sign, I'm off trying to hustle like my own thing. So you have to let the ego.
You'd be out of
right. You, in the very raw sense, you have to let that ego go and be open, because when you have that ego, you're not open to listening to anybody. So you have to be open to listening, because there's so many things I learned from these people that I had to be an assistant for, and then I had to be out in the field and report back to. I learned how to do these jobs like somebody might learn how to be a carpenter, or somebody might learn how to be a plumber. I learned how to read SoundScan, how to read the billboard charts, what it means, what affects those things, what, you know, I learned nuances in politics and of the corporate structure and how that interacts with the artistry and the managers. And there's just so many facets. I think if I was awestruck when I first interned at Interscope, because I don't know what I thought Interscope Records was before. Maybe I just thought it was like three dudes sitting around a desk, but like there's like a whole building there, right? And there's floors and there's like jobs for people. And I don't think I ever quite recognized that until I saw it for myself. And I think that, you know, in Kansas City or Lawrence, the only record companies I ever saw was Strange Music and the ones that we were like running with, either Lock and Load or whoever else, right? Yeah. And so that's what your impression is. That's the only business you're gonna get. Like, I learned a lot from Travis and Tech on how to promote and how to be everywhere at once and how to, like, you know, just pump up your base and travel to them and be constantly working. And but I don't know that if I would have learned anything else other than that, because I would have stayed doing that. Yeah. And I think, you know, you have to like move and get out there and start opening yourself up to new experiences by surrendering to those new experiences and not trying to force yourself onto them. I wasn't trying to force X-Dash onto Interscope Records. I was just being frank.
Gotcha. Well, okay. So let me finish my story. So I go out to, perfectly fine. I go out to Denver. I have this whole Macklemore experience. I like the album. He's got a song about fucking baseball. I'm like, this kid's just being him, right? So the Grammys come around, and everybody's pissed off that Macklemore won and Good Kid, Mad City didn't win. And I'm talking to my son, and he's like, he agrees. He loves Macklemore, but he's like, fuck that. Well, I hadn't heard the album. And the thing about that album is, you have to take it as a whole piece, right?
Yeah.
There's not, you can't really take it in individual chunks, and I didn't know that. So I was pro Macklemore in that situation until after To Pimp a Butterfly, when I realized, okay, this dude's making concept albums. Then I went back and I was like, oh my God. Like, fuck, can we delete that shit? Like, where are those fucking posts? Because I got to delete that shit. Okay, so anyway.
I would tell you, To Pimp a Butterfly is my favorite. It took me a minute to understand what Kendrick was doing. It took me understanding the van and with and everything on Good Kid, Mad City and where he was going and all the story. And, you know, once you realize you're sort of watching or you're listening to Boys in the Hood, kind of, once you realize that that's what's going on, I think you like, it's an eye-opening experience. You're like, oh shit. To Pimp a Butterfly is so interesting because you have to listen to it backwards almost. You have to go to the very end where he's interviewing Tupac and hear what he says. And then you have to listen backwards because he's building that poem all the way through line by line. So he's like, just says the first line in the first few songs. Then he just says like a little bit more of the song. And then like you get to the end and you realize it's him sharing a poem with Tupac about, you know, it's just so the dope, dude is dope. Yeah, the dude is unreal.
I agree.
He's on the next level.
He's a generational artist. And when they talk about, you know, this generation, a lot of people, you know, a lot of the old grumpy men, old grumpy hip hop heads want to bitch about this generation and make it seem like it's just one thing, right? Well, no, yeah. Kendrick is a generational artist. He fits in any generation. It doesn't matter. He's dope. Dope is fucking dope. Okay, so in the last 5 years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Man. Say the descriptors again. What in behavior?
What new belief, behavior,
new belief,
or habit?
Man. Well, I think that obviously I've worked from home in the past. When I traveled with bands, I had to work from home. But I've had to work from home in like a shed here, and I've had to use Zoom and sort of, you know, in the past, I think if I wanted to call someone, I just pick the phone up and call them. We had this technology, we had Zoom, we had the ability to tap into conference rooms in New York and see their whole conference room and see ours. And I think that this forced us to incorporate this new technology into our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll use an example. I went to burn a CD a few years ago, and I didn't have a burner on my laptop. And I'm like, I felt like I just was sitting there dumbfounded with this stupid look on my face. Like, how do I make a burn CD? Yeah. And then it occurred to me that I had been getting into my car, which would automatically connect to Bluetooth, which would automatically then play whatever Spotify or Apple Music playlist I had going. And it had phased out the CD so much that as a guy who used to get burnt discs from you to listen to beats or burn things for other people to listen, it had been so phased out. And it wasn't that I, like, of course it gets phased out, but it's that I didn't notice it get phased out, yeah. That it just so sort of seamlessly happened. This sort of jerked us into having to like use Zoom, and everybody now is Zoomed out, right? But I really feel like it actually allows for more opportunity to talk to someone face to face. I haven't talked to you face to face in 12 years. I don't know when the last time I saw you.
I don't either.
So, yeah. Right. So, and we probably would have just not happily, but just like gone on with our lives, only texting little like things back and forth.
Yeah.
But this allows for us to actually have a conversation. It allows for a community. And I used to say that what I was talking about with the community with Beazle and the t-shirt with Will, we lost that community in music anyway, and in hip hop anyway. You know, you might have an Odd Future shirt on nowadays, and I might have a Machine Gun Kelly shirt on, and we might not ever even think we're part of the same culture. Yeah. And we have people like Diddy and Russell Simmons and other cats from our generation, Master P and the guys down at Rap-A-Lot. They made sure that there was sort of a culture and a boundary and rules. And I just feel like we don't really have that anymore. And so hopefully like being able to talk to you, even though we're not in the same area, we're not in the same vicinity, I'm able to sit here face to face with you, and then we're able to talk to the folks. So I think that's a behavior that has changed in me and for the better, and I appreciate it. I'm like you. I saw this year as an excuse to not do shit and to not, you know, like I kind of sometimes think I'm Larry David running around LA. I find myself in similar situations, and I'm grumpy and I'm set in my ways in some ways. And so I find myself in similar things, but I found it like the pandemic is an excuse to just not ever take my pajamas off and work from home all the time, right? No, and be with my kids. So, but I think that I have to be on camera. And so being on camera every day talking to people is like in a world where I don't have any choice about it. I have to do it. So in the old world, I might've just like shut my door and listened in on the conference line, you know, for a meeting that I didn't want to really go to or something, right? So I think it's forced me to like, I don't know, be camera ready, be ready to talk to people, be, you know, outgoing and use this technology, you know, to benefit us, not to hinder us. And that's what it is. I think it'll be incorporated into everything going forward. Watches. I mean, like, look, your car, you know, we're going to have driverless cars soon at some point, they're talking about. And like, you know, imagine the inner, you know, you might have 3D things that come up in the middle of the car, and it's your grandparents and you're talking to them while you're waiting, you know? So I think we should embrace the technology. I'm glad it moved us out of the Stone Age and sort of into this like virtual world.
Hell yeah. Great answer. So what advice would you give to a smart, driven kid about to enter the real world?
That you're not owed anything. No one owes you anything. You're not going to get everything you want right out the gate. You're not going to be the CEO of the company that you're interning for. You have to have realistic expectations for the entry-level positions that you get in. I've never once asked for more money. I've never once asked for a title increase. I've never once asked for anything, because I just show up and I let the work speak for itself, and that's worked out for me. Again, everybody's path is different. I don't know what you're trying to do or what you want to do, but you have to play the game. And I think so many young people aren't playing the game. I don't know why. I don't know if it's the participation trophy sort of era where everybody got a participation. I'm not sure what it is. And this is, I'm not trying to sound like an old guy that's like shitting on kids, but you have to understand that you don't know anything, and that you're at an entry level, and that's okay. You know, very few people, what's funny is, let's say one of those songs from Workaholic or There Goes the Neighborhood actually blew up, and I became this like overnight star for some stupid song I had, like Laffy Taffy or something. And would I have been prepared to handle that kind of success? No way. I didn't have any infrastructure, as real infrastructure as like a record label behind me. It's like a little makeshift dream that I was living. I had no way of really, you know, now I've worked, and there's levels to it. And, you know, just as you pass it's like trying to play Mario, you know, you want to play Mario all the way through, because the last level's hard, and you learn different tricks along the way to like beat the end boss. If you warp all the way to the top, you're going to get killed by the end boss, because you don't know what's coming. You've never seen the type of fireballs he's throwing and all that stuff. So real life is the same way. Like, Tom Brady didn't show up one day and become Tom Brady. And I hate Tom Brady because he beat my Chiefs, but he didn't just show up. He didn't just roll up. I mean, he played little league football, and he played high school football, and he played college football, and he wasn't even all that good in all those years, but he kept showing up and working hard, and he got better and better in the off season. And he goes out there, and he didn't win that Super Bowl by just showing up. He spent all season practicing, working, waking up at 4 a.m. and drinking raw eggs or whatever the fuck he does. Like, you have to do the work, and you have to show up and sort of get in where you fit in. All at the same time, you can be yourself. That's what people like. They like it when you're yourself, but you can't be the type of person that's demanding a raise because you've been there for 6 months. Or, you know, think of all the people that have worked at the company longer than you that aren't doing that. So that's what I say. I think young people have unreasonable expectations of what anybody owes them when they go into the workplace.
Dope. Is this instant gratification culture that we have? You know, you put a picture online and you expect 100 people to react to it and tell you how beautiful you are, you know, and then it just, after many years, it just becomes, you know, what you expect. So that's great advice. In the last 5 years, what have you become better at saying no to? Distractions, invitations, etc.
In 2016, when Trump won the election and my mom lost her election, my mom ran for attorney general in Missouri. She ran against none other than now Senator Josh Hawley, insurrectionist Josh Hawley. And my mom lost to him as Missouri attorney general because Trump beat Hillary by 20 points in Missouri. And that's okay, that elections happen and people win and lose. And we lost, and I decided at that moment that I couldn't tell who was who anymore in my life. I couldn't tell, you know, I was so upset that we could elect somebody like him that I felt like if you were for him, I didn't really want anything to do with you. And there were so many people against, just, you know, the thought that I don't want to go too much into politics, but just I couldn't tell on I was on Facebook. I couldn't tell. I felt like the people who were against Hillary on the left were saying the same things that were against Hillary on the right. And then we found out it was all Russian propaganda. And I could see something was happening when my cousin that was for Bernie was now saying the same things Trump was saying. And I just couldn't tell like who was who anymore or what people believed or what they stood in. And I knew what I stood for and I knew what I believed in, but I didn't know if you did or someone else did. So I decided in 2016 to just quit Facebook. I deaded an 816 number that I'd had for my entire life. And I didn't tell anybody. I just decided that I had been fed up. I was just going to focus on my career in Los Angeles. I was going to focus on my wife. My wife and I were struggling to have a baby, and now we have a beautiful 3-year-old. But I knew that I needed to put energy into that and only focus on sort of my mom picking up the pieces from losing a big election like that. My wife and I trying to very desperately to have a baby. And at that moment in my life, I was at a critical moment in my career and I needed to focus on those things. And so what I did was I just decided to eliminate all connections. And I called it hiding in plain sight because I was still on Instagram. And you could find me on LinkedIn and you could call my employer. I mean, I'd given my business card out to a million people. So people had my you know, work information. And if you really wanted to find me, you probably could. And I found out that nobody was really trying to find me. And that's okay because I sort of felt like I didn't owe anybody anything at that moment and nobody owed me anything. And I was perfectly fine with just disappearing and regrouping. And now I don't remember like any of those people that I was mad at politically and all of that. And I don't really care. I found a way to sort of block out noise. I didn't watch the news for the longest time, like, because I just didn't want to feel bad. You know, you watch the news, you hear about some kid getting shot, or I'd have to hear about your homie that died. And it's just like, I needed that time for me to be frank and to start my family and to build my foundation. And, you know, I guess I just really came into being a man, you know, like, it sounds corny, but like, no. I don't think I'd ever really felt like a man until I decided to disappear and focus on those things. So,
you know, it's one of the things I love about you, bro, is when you commit to something, you fucking go for it. You know what I'm saying? Even if it's something like that where, you know, you're not afraid to be uncomfortable. You know, like, fuck the comfort zone. You know, like, I think I'm going to make a t-shirt. Just fuck the comfort zone, bro.
Well, and you know, like, no offense to Kansas City, but all these, everybody's like, oh, I put on for my city. Well, I mean, no offense, but Kansas City didn't get me that internship at Interscope. Kansas City, like the putting on for the city shit didn't do it for me. Like, and that doesn't mean I can't have my grandparents all live in Kansas City. My mom and dad still live in Kansas City. I still love the city of Kansas City and everything that's about it. But I think you got to lose that a little bit because Kansas City's not out there repping me every day. And so you have to kind of stop repping for other people and you have to be yourself. You have to find out who you are and then fucking go for whatever it is you want.
Love it, man. Okay. Two more questions and then we'll wrap it up. I mean, we can sit here. Me and you, man, it's been so long.
I can chop we it can up, talk.
Why? Yeah, all fucking day. So when you feel overwhelmed or unfocused or have lost your focus temporarily, what do you do?
I just stop whatever it is I'm doing. And I walk away from it for a little bit. And then, you know, whether I drink something or smoke something or talk to my wife or I just regroup. I stop and then I go, and chances are the answer comes to you, or you'll think about it for a little bit. You know, you can't, not everything affords you the opportunity to just stop. But I think if I'm stuck, instead of just like forcing it, I usually just stop and I go take a break and do something else. And then I come back to it, and chances are I've found the answer.
Hell yeah. So last question, bro. What's your favorite song? Do you have a song that you consider the soundtrack to your life?
Man, I mean, I have a poem. Does a poem count?
Hell yeah.
When I was 7 or 8 years old, I was 8 years old. I was watching The Simpsons, and The Simpsons have an episode called Treehouse of Horrors. And in that episode, there's like three different stories. So it was the very first season of The Simpsons. So it was 1990. It was like September or October of 1990. And there had only been like maybe 10 episodes of The Simpsons at all. And then they did a Halloween special. And like in that Halloween special, Treehouse of Horrors, they have three different stories. And one of the stories is Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, and they redo it in like Simpsons way.
Okay.
And what's really interesting is The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air had aired just a month before that on primetime TV.
Okay.
So my 8-year-old brain like loved Will Smith in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air show. And then when I saw Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, I didn't know who Edgar Allan Poe was or what The Raven, the poem was, but I saw the Simpsons version of it, cartoon-wise, and the iambic pentameter of it. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I wandered weak and weary over a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as if someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door, "only this and nothing more. Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and every separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor." Like my 8-year-old brain made that hip hop to me for some reason.
It sounded like you were spitting bars.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know if like I also remember the Christian Okoye Chiefs poster. There was a Chiefs poster that had a Christian Okoye with the nightmare on Elm Street. It was like the Nigerian nightmare.
Yeah.
All the kids that I grew up with, it spend the night at a kid's house or something, and he'd have that poster on his wall. And then, so I don't know if it was like the combination of Will Smith's Nightmare on My Street, combined with that Christian Okoye poster, combined with the Simpsons Raven version, then me discovering sort of iambic pentameter. But that poem made me a rapper. And I memorized it, and my mom and dad were like, my mom heard me like memorized it from the show. And she was like, "Are you saying Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And so she got me the poem in this like book, and I memorized it. And by like 9 years old, I could spit the entire Raven poem. It's a long poem. Yeah. And I knew it word for word. I don't know all of it still to this day, but I know enough of it I can do that. And,
yeah.
So that, that shaped and changed me in like a weird, weird way. And so then, make it even spookier for you, Will the Weirdo is born on the same day as Edgar Allan Poe. And Will the Weirdo's real name is Will Wilson. And Edgar Allan Poe has a poem called Will Wilson.
Wow. That's dope, man. Mind blowing. I'm with you.
That's
man.
Like
That's
fate.
Crazy.
Like how did like little Frank one day would mess around with weird ass Will.
Yeah.
And Edgar Allan Poe's like in the subconscious of it all. So anyway.
That's dope, man.
I found that odd.
Great answer, bro. Great fucking answer. So listen, man. Again, it's been years since we talked or, you know, actually spoken, right? But I just want to let you know how proud I am of you, bro. And
thank you, man.
I not just for, you know, your professional accomplishments, but like who you've become as a dad, who you've become as a husband, a man, you know what I'm saying? And from seeing you as a young kid and seeing where you are now, it's very inspiring. So I just want to let you know that, bro. I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Keep pushing, man. Thank you for taking the time to do this. It was actually a great interview. I don't think we had any skips or pops or any fucking thing. I
How
mean,
many people did we have? We have anybody actually tune in?
We had up to 9 or 10.
And we had about 9 or 10 live
All right.
viewers, but
That's okay.
you know what happens is they'll catch it throughout the week. You know,
Great.
so Will's is at 700 something, and when I actually figure out what the hell I'm doing, because this was more about stop talking
Yeah.
about it, just get going and
Just do it. No,
figure it
I
out.
heard you. Yeah, I heard
Yeah.
you. I'll just say I'm proud of you too, man, because I think that the pandemic, if you couldn't figure out how to hustle something up in this pandemic, then you're not a hustler, or you're not like you, because it doesn't matter what it is, podcast or this going live on Facebook or whatever it is, like we've been saying this whole time, you have to find out what it is you're passionate about. So many of my homies growing up, they all work for their moms and dads to this day. They're like 39 or 40 and they're working for their dads, whatever. And that's not their life. That's not what they wanted to do. And it's because they never really knew what they wanted to do. They just did what everybody else told them to do. And that wasn't for me. I didn't want to be a lawyer like my parents. And I didn't want to be the person that most of those people that I grew up around wanted me to be. And that's why I am living in Los Angeles, is because I followed what Frank wanted to do. And so I think that you start in this pandemic, you start in this talk show during this pandemic at a time when people have really no other choice but to communicate this way, and have some and try to have a central hub for a community. That's exactly what's needed. That's exactly what's needed. And you should be proud of yourself too for being that guiding light for young people, because you're the one that's making that happen. I didn't organize that. I'm on here just to tell you my path, and Will's on here to tell his path, but like you're the one organizing it for them. And so yeah, I'm proud of you, man, for trying something new and doing it.
No doubt. Thank you, man. Well, it was great to talk to you, man. I'll let you get back to your Sunday. You know what I'm
I just want to
saying?
know who was who. I had the ball game on behind me, but it shut off. I was trying to figure out who won Michigan there.
I have no idea.
I got money on it. I got money on it.
Well, let's go then. All right, bro. Well, you have a great evening, man. Thank you, homie. Love
I'll
you,
see you
bro.
guys.
Yeah.
Love you, man.
Yeah.
Bye.